one other caveat. We've been told many times, and Mike, you might be able to help us with this. If you're looking for negotiating financial aid and merit scholarships, we suggest that you not apply early because there's nothing to negotiate. They have you. If you've applied early decision, it says, I want to go. So you can't say, well, I have three schools, and this one's offered me this, and this one's offered me that, and let's talk about financial aid. You have nothing to negotiate because you signed on the dotted line, I'm coming there. So they're going to give you the least amount that they can get away with instead of the highest amount they can get away with. I mean, that's an outsider's view at a college, but Mike, what do you hear about that?
Before I give an answer to that, the other perspective the other perspective I'd like to take on this is, remember when I talked about the college-going process and the pressure that's involved, the tension that's going on in a family? Recognize, too, that the early decision process can take away some of that. If you know where you want to go, you're committed to that particular institution, and that's where you want to be, and that's where you want to be for the next 4 years, you can take away some of those pressures by applying. And that's really, I think, what early decision is all about. On the other hand, to go back to Andrea's question, when you go out to the open market, you do have probably some more negotiating skills, or at least potentially different options than you would have if you stay to one selected institution. There are certainly reports that some institutions treat their financial aid candidates differently for early decision than they do for regular decision, but I think each case, each institution is different, and to generalize, I think, would be incorrect to do. So I think that as an individual family, you've got to decide what path you want to go down, and the one that fits your needs and your style the best is the one you should go down. And a few dollars is not necessarily going to make a difference. I think the more important part is to find the right school for the applicant.
But to try to summarize, don't use early admissions as a way of reducing your family stress if you're not sure that that's the school you want to go in.
Absolutely.
While at the same time, if you're really in that 99% area and you're willing to commit, then you may want to go early decision. And it's not clear whether doing that reduces your financial bargaining tool or whether or not it's kind of I got you now, so you may not get the grant money or the extent. And Mike, what you're saying is that's not clear.
That's not.
The other thing, and let's take the opposite end of this, we're talking about early decision and being very selective. I am also not an advocate that says you need to have 24 different colleges on your list. As Peter indicated earlier, this is an expensive process all the way around, and by adding that number of colleges to your base, you've certainly geared up to handle some expenses that are more than what are average. So I think somewhere in the middle you're going to find the truth, and you're going to find a selected group of institutions that meet your needs. And again, I'll go back from a financial aid perspective. At this time of year, the most important thing to do is to make sure that you know and understand the process for applying for financial aid and do it on time.
Bruce, if I could just, just to wrap up the early action, early decision question, a common question that I get is regarding what happens if I'm not accepted early. I sound like I'm repeating myself, but I think you have to check with the institution, because some schools will universally defer students to regular admission. Some schools will, from a counseling standpoint, if they know that a student, based upon their academic profile, even given new information, whether it's testing information or first semester or first trimester grades, will not be competitive at regular admission, they will deny that student. So I think you have to check that there are institutions that will defer you, but there are also institutions that, if you're not admitted, will deny you outright. And I think you'll find that at all schools, if someone is deferred to regular admission, they're given every consideration that someone who just applies regular outright. But that's a common question, so I just wanted to bring that up.
Thanks, Pete. And at this point in the program, I want to do a couple things. One is that we're going to take questions in probably the next 10 or 15 minutes. And for those people who may want to ask questions in our audience, all you need to do is dial 1-4 on your touch-tone phone, and that will signal Vicki, our operator, that you are interested in asking a question. If during the course of time you want to withdraw your question, you simply need to dial 1-3 and you withdraw the question. If for some reason you're having any technical difficulties or hearing problems on the line, you can let Vicki know by dialing *0 on the line, and that will get you the operator, and you can explain the problem that you may be experiencing. I want to quickly reintroduce the people we have here in the conference room and then move on with some more questions. We have Andrea Glovsky from Work Family Directions, who is responsible for the college counseling program, and Peter Caruso, who's Assistant Director of Admissions at Boston College, and Mike Bartini, Director of Financial Aid Services for the College Board. Mike and Andrea, you hear stories about millions of dollars out there for scholarships and money and untapped resources. How can people find that, and is it true, and do you have to go off and buy that kind of service from somebody, or can you go off and start surfing the net and get the same answers?
The first thing is that I think this information is pretty readily available. If you go back 10 years ago, there were not the opportunities today for people to get the information that's now available free to most applicants. The first place I would look is your high school guidance office. There may be a variety of printed publications that you can look through. Basically, what you're going to do is you're going to match you as an individual up with a scholarship that has some of the criteria, you have some of the criteria that they're looking for, whether it be academic, athletic, and or some other type of criteria. And many guidance counselors today have ways in which you can get this information on computer, whether it's in-house and or on the World Wide Web. There are scholarship search organizations out there who offer this free to applicants. One of the things, if it's free, certainly you can go out there and test it and see how it works. There's nothing lost. At this particular point, I'm having a hard time encouraging anybody to pay for this information. I just don't think that with the vehicles available today, whether they're through Work Family Direction, the College Board, Sallie Mae, whatever website you happen to go to, I just think that information is out there. And remember, everybody thinks that if you find a scholarship that matches up to your particular profile, you're all set. That's only the first step. The next step is applying. And there's a selection process that you have to go through, and you're going to be one of many applicants. So the other piece of advice is to do this and do it early and get as much information as possible. So I'll turn it back to Andrea.
Who might have a couple of points are, number one, we tell people if you have to pay for it, anything to do with the college process, then it's no good.
Except for applying.
But I'm talking about, you know, if you're buying scholarship programs or someone who's going to find you this wondrous financial aid or who's going to do your financial aid planner for you or, you know, who's going to do your, you know, fill out your FAFSA for you. There's no need of that. First of all, the process isn't very difficult. Finding scholarships can be found. You know, Mike's very modest, but College Board has a wonderful thing called Fund Finder that we all use and we love that does a wonderful scholarship search that doesn't cost anything, and it's in most of our high schools. If you live in Massachusetts, there's a wonderful thing at the Boston Public Library. Go in there. Their higher ed department has terrific resources. There's lots and lots of money out there, but all readily available, known to your high school guidance counselors and known through the internet and known through programs. There's no need to pay for it. In terms of scholarship, though, you have to beware. If you receive a $5,000 scholarship from someplace, wondrously, that you worked hard by doing two science projects and writing three essays, you have to know that they alert the college to that. And most colleges will deduct that from their package. We have learned that if you get $5,000 in scholarship money, then the college says, oh, good, then your need is $5,000 less. So it doesn't reduce what the college, it reduce your expected family contribution, it reduces what the college has to give you. And so all that hard work may not get you what you want in the end.
Unless that award was merit-based.
unless the award was merit-based, right. So we have to be careful.
And or the institution did not meet your original need.
Or the institution didn't meet your need. But it doesn't necessarily mean if you got $5,000 that suddenly you wouldn't have to contribute $5,000. So be careful that you don't misread what the scholarship's going to do for you. By the way, most of the major scholarships in the country for many of the major companies that give out scholarships, national organizations and things like that, the deadlines tend to be October, November, so be careful that you look for them early so that you don't miss the deadlines. Again, go to your guidance office. They have them all posted. Most students don't like to go to the guidance office for this kind of stuff, but stop in once or twice a month, and you may have all these applications readily available to you.
In addition to that, in at least closing on this topic here, my advice is do not leave any stone unturned. We're talking to a group, you know, your employers, but your spouse may be employed at another organization, your church, civic organizations, and even your high school will give out, in some cases, substantial amounts of money. So indeed, look at everything, apply for everything possible. It is going to be an expensive proposition no matter where you go to college. And it's important that if resources from the family are not sufficient, to explore every opportunity available.
And going back to my own personal experience, dealing with the scholarship application processes and multiple can be as time-consuming and complex as it was to just apply for the school in the first place.
Absolutely.
And in many cases have seen organizations really put kids through a variety of hoops in writing those paragraphs and those wish lists and the future careers and so forth.
Some
and filling out very...
projects.
Yeah, or filling out some very detailed financial forms, particularly if they're need-based.
But the payoff can be tremendous. And, you know, from a student's perspective, I think what you want to do is think in terms of 4 years. Where do you want to be in 4 years from today? And if it's resources that you need in order to get there, you've got to make the application process. You've got to find the best educational institution for you. And it's a lot of hard work, but I think the payoff is tremendous.
And there is money once you get to campuses in very interesting ways. There are stipends on campus to work for professors. There's all kinds of money that you, if you keep your eyes and ears open and you actually pursue it, there is money to be had on campus. My own child received money from a professor by working for them.
Or restricted
scholarship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of those things turn into summer jobs and summer stipends. And it's amazing. There is money to be awarded during the school years once you get there. So it doesn't mean just because I didn't get anything before I got there. And a lot of these things you apply for only apply to that first year, a lot of the community things. So when you get there, it's a four-year continual process to try and get that money to pay for school. It's not a one-shot, one-time.
The key word is renewable.
Renewable. Yes, everybody look.
Actually, my key word is persistence. These things are not going to come out and touch you on the hands. You're going to have to go find them. So in many cases, the legwork on your end is going to seem to be endless. But next May, let's hope that it all proves to be quite
right.
Beneficial.
So it's a second job, at least for that senior year.
It's a stressful time. And it is, but I think the more time and effort you put into it, the more you do it as a family, I think, and let me stress the fact of doing it as a family, the more that you all get involved in this process, I think the easier the decision next May is going to be.
One fun, quick tip that we did, and I've suggested to another parent, start reading your local newspaper in April of every year and clip out every award that everyone in your community has won. It's amazing. You could have an incredible scrapbook if you started with ninth grade, and half of them, a lot of people don't apply to every year. A student will happen to have learned about some unusual group in your community. Well, guess what? Your child may be the next one to do that. So start a little scrapbook early, because that scrapbook by senior year could turn out to be very valuable. So that's a little tip that not too many people have thought of.
So clearly, as you unravel what we've been talking about so far this evening, we've talked about the financial issues, we've talked about the admission processes and what to expect. We've tried to distinguish the fact that you have situations in which if you're a sophomore in a family with a sophomore, You need to be doing certain things now that you can do in terms of searching for schools and experimenting on a low-level basis. If you're a junior, you're worried about the testing cycles, but also visiting schools and making decisions. And if you're and talking about volunteerism and getting involved. And certainly if you're in your senior year, some of the your future course has been decided between your freshman, sophomore, and junior year, but there's still a lot to do, and certainly a lot in building and beginning to focus in on your application process, which leads us to begin to talk about applications.
One thing we forgot about money and testing all tied together. Remember, October PSATs, everybody that is a junior should take their PSAT test because that is the way to get into the National Merit Scholarship Program. We forgot to mention that. Your sophomore year doesn't count. The only one that counts is your junior year. So take that PSAT in, is it, October, it's in the next couple of weeks. So
we put all the test information and the dates for this year up on our website,
right.
The Work-Life Connection
website. It's all
website.
Out there. I just can't remember the
And
date.
Before I forget, our Work-Life Connection website can be reached through the HR homepage at hr.imc.das.dec.com. And unfortunately, that's on the inside of the firewall. But if you're razzing in or whatever, you can get in and take a look at the internet sites and look at the different testing things, testing dates. I think the last piece about the application process itself is for the seniors out there, they've probably got them laid out on the table, and you've got
Hopefully organized.
As organized as perhaps this table looks like with the pizza boxes and so forth. Do you fill out the common application? Do you go out on the internet? Do you fill, you know, some schools, what's the process today, Pete, and what should parents be looking for?
Well, I think more and more, and this goes to a point that Mike made before regarding 24 applications, I think it's becoming more of an inflated applicant pool. I think more students are applying to 7, 8, 10 schools because of access, because of the web, because of the fact that more schools are going to the common application, more schools are going to the Peterson's Universal application. A couple of cases in recent years where schools went to the common application, Tufts University, which is in Medford, Massachusetts, went 2 years ago, and I believe their application shot up by 40%, which is astronomical. There really isn't a preference whether they use the common application, whether they download it from the web, whether they use Apply System software or College Link or X-Pan. I don't think an institution would willingly subscribe to that service if they weren't going to give the student who applied through the common application every bit of consideration that they would someone who applied through the view book or through the bulletin. So that's a common question, Bruce, that comes up a lot.
It's very expensive to apply to a lot of schools, and some families really can't afford it. There are fee waivers, is that correct?
Right, and they're usually through College Board, and also sometimes in individual cases, if we get letters from a guidance counselor where there's a personal hardship, we'll certainly make exemptions in those cases.
Does it make a difference whether you're reading something that's coming out of the common application, for example, as compared to that application you've gotten directly from the school that has their name and letterhead, and that you've, if you can even find a typewriter nowadays to even try to complete or fill out, does it make a difference?
No, it doesn't. And I know that sometimes is hard to believe, but I don't think a school should really be subscribing to those services if they're actually going to be making a distinction between someone who uses the common application as opposed to someone who uses the regular format.
I'd like to let our audience know that we're getting close to being able to accept any questions, and all you have to do is dial in 1-4 on your phone and let Vicki know that that you would like to ask a question. And Vicki, just let us know if we do have any questions waiting on the line, okay?
At this time, we do have two participants standing by.
Why don't we take our first question?
Dan White from Lilburn, Georgia. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, one question regarding financial aid is President Clinton has been talking about IRAs that can be purchased that you can draw on early for financial aid, And does that apply to existing 401ks and retirement plans and whatnot?
I will attempt to answer that question. For all of us, there are going to be some changes within the tax law that will affect financing of higher education. Most of them will not kick in until January 1st, 1998. There are several things. There's a HOPE scholarship credit. There's a lifelong learning credit. There is also an opportunity, and God, I should know these off the top of my head, there are IRA contributions that you can make. With regard to the IRA contribution that you can make, for younger children, that may be the right thing to do. The one thing you need to do is, if you're doing your own personal financing, you need to sit down and you need to read all the options that you have. Because, for instance, if you contribute to an IRA, I believe that you're restricted from using some of the other programs like the HOPE scholarship deduction. And so there are some restrictions that you're going to need to pay attention to. There are several good publications out there, and I feel fairly certain if you go to the government website, they have a piece out on scholarships. But hopefully I've given you a little bit of information. Lots of this is new to us. And one of the things that you're probably concerned about from a family perspective is take for instance the credit where indeed from your tax return you would have money coming back to you. The financial aid process is dealing with that right now. In particular, Congress is dealing with that, because remember that for federal funds anyway, Congress mandates the formula used, and they're trying to at this point here change the formula so that that doesn't get included in terms of your family contribution. It would be additional money for the family. So keep posted to what's going on in the newspaper on that.
And Dan, what we're going to try to do over the coming months as Work Family does a further analysis of this and we get further information, is try to post some things on our website so that we can keep all the employees informed as we get more information, or at least provide some hot links out to other sites where we can identify where there's some good information.
Being from Georgia, the HOPE scholarship has come from Georgia, and it's a replication of what you have. And how it's going to affect all of you, we don't know. And so as we learn how to help you understand all of these processes, we'll try and share that information with you. Hopefully Mike will keep us up to speed, and we'll all be ready in January to answer your questions a little better.
Dan, does that help you?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Vicki, we have another call?
We have Donna Curtis from Amherst.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, I'm calling from New Hampshire, and it sounded like a lot of the people on the board are from the Northeast. And just recently I heard on a talk show on the radio that people in the Northeast part of the country tend to think of college costing $20,000 to $30,000 a year, but that plenty of students in the Midwest and in the South get a good education for $3,000 to $5,000 a year. Does anyone have a sense for different parts of the country as far as colleges and the costs are concerned? For example, the University of Indiana, University of Florida, I'm just hearing that their costs to go to college there are much less.
Well, Andrew is going to tackle that one. In
about 2 seconds, but he's going to start first.
You're going to start, Pete?
Well,
can afford
college. Exactly. Donna, did you say your name was?
Yes.
In conversations that I've had with guidance counselors, a number of schools from outside of the Northeast have been visiting secondary schools in the Northeast, and I think that because of costs, particularly on the coasts, more and more students are being encouraged to broaden their horizons and to look at places in the Midwest and places like Rice in Houston, Texas, which is one of the most selective schools in the country and is competitive price-wise to any rival school in the Northeast. I think you look at, if you look at some of the areas that I recruit in, Donna, like North Carolina, Virginia in particular, where the state system is tremendous. You've got UVA, William & Mary, Virginia Tech. And not only students from in-state trying to get them to come east, but also I think it's important that these schools are some of the more selective in the country, and the cost is certainly competitive. And in terms of thousands of dollars less than schools in the Northeast. I think the other thing, too, is the practical issues. You know, do I want my son or daughter to go 4 or 5 hours away by plane? So those are some of the issues that always come up when looking at schools. But
the cost of the airfare may be nothing compared to the savings of tuition.
Right. And Indiana, what we find, the schools in the Midwest range for out-of-state students around $12,000 plus room and board. So they are going to cost less than the $20,000 because room and board isn't going to cost what it costs to live in Boston.
Right.
It's going to be $3,000 a year as opposed to, I don't know what BC's is, probably five.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
BC's room and board is probably five.
It's almost nine.
It's nine? Okay.
I should have said five before, you know.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
When you're talking about the Midwest, you're talking about room and board costing between three and five.
Correct.
As opposed to five and nine.
Mm-hmm.
So so even if tuition is $11,000 or $12,000, you add another, you know, five, you're still under $20,000. So in some ways, they are bargains. A lot of these schools, though, are very large.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, large universities, Purdue, Indiana, Virginia, North Carolina. I was at North Carolina the other day. You know, there are 24,000 students at UNC. That's a large mm-hmm. school campus. You have to be ready to handle that size campus that far away from home. So there are lots of things to weigh in the process of looking at schools when you leave the Northeast. You know, we are spoiled. We all, you know, everything's very close here in the Northeast. When you leave the Northeast, things are a lot further apart. And, you know, you just have to, has to be part of your factoring in.
But, Donna, I think there are a lot of gems out there when you consider there are so many accredited institutions out there. And maybe... some of the schools might not roll easily off the tongue, or you might not recognize them, but there are a lot of schools that are small to mid-sized liberal arts institutions that may meet your son or daughter's needs and expectations as far as what a school is, and they may be within your range price-wise.
And how would you find them?
That's something
we can help you do at Work Family. I would suggest that you call one of the college counselors at the 1-800 number, and they would walk you through a list and help you locate a list of schools outside, you know, further away that fit your criteria. You may want schools in the Midwest or the South or something. We could walk you through that process and help you come up with that.
Plus, Donna, just go to the guidance office. I mean, the guidance office should have a number of different programs because...
Software programs.
Software
right?
programs.
You can do that on internet. Yeah. They all have internet.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well,
right.
and again, you can call Work Family Directions, which is our vendor for digital, at 1-800-635-0606, and talk with one of the college planning counselors. And there's no charge for that service, and they can walk you through, send off... a wealth of information. And that's also true. I would urge parents whose kids are in their sophomore or junior year to even call and really begin the process of taking a look at this information that Work Family has put together and the services available. So I hope that helps, Donna.
Donna, by the way, UNH is $12,000 plus room and board, so
right.
I'm not sure Indiana is that much a bargain, and you don't have to drive very far.
Right.
So. But don't be afraid to look in your own backyard at some of our state schools. They are quite excellent.
That's right. Thank you. Vicki?
Thank you.
We have Lewis Adaman from Newton, Mississippi.
Close, but Newton, Mass. But...
I was going to say. I
have some questions about Southern schools. my question revolves around finance. And is it better to have the funds for the school in the child's name or in the parent's name?
Are you talking about someone who's applying for financial aid in the upcoming year?
Yes.
Or are you talking 2 or 3 years down the line?
Actually, both.
Okay. One answer I'm going to give you is going to be a little bit conflicting. If... You need to speak with a financial advisor as to where the best place your family money should be. In some cases, because of your tax situation, it should stay with the student. In some cases, it should be with the parent. Another question, of course, is whose is the money? Is the money yours or is it the student's? In the financial aid process, a dollar's worth of assets held by the student will be looked at much more heavily than a dollar's worth of assets held in the parent's name. That's a standard. And so that might seem to answer your question, but it may not give you the correct answer depending on your full family circumstances financially. So I don't mean to be giving you a complete answer. This is open-ended, and it needs further discussion with somebody who has that expertise.
We recommend using financial planners, primarily ones who do not sell products, who are actually licensed or certified financial planners who are not in the market to sell you something else that they need to, some kind of fund or something else. So a good financial planner should be able to put that out on the table and look at it and say, gee, you know, if you move the money out of your child's name, your tax penalty will be at to such an extreme that it would make no sense, and you know you're not going to get financial aid anyway, that right. kind of thing. So you have to have somebody really look at that picture.
Now that's a service.
And you're recommending someone who charges a fee.
Well, and in fact, that's what I was just saying, is that a financial planner who, in fact, may charge by the hour for
by
that
By the
service,
hour. It's like hiring a lawyer or seeing a doctor. It's that kind of a person. It's a fee for service.
I see. Any range here in Massachusetts?
Any range for cost? For
hourly range?
I don't know.
Again, let me qualify, and Andrea may have a different opinion. I'm speaking of a family financial planner, not a financial aid planner.
Right.
Someone who's helping you manipulate your assets for college.
I'm not talking about financial aid. I'm talking about a family financial planner who looks at where your money is, your 401ks, how it's invested, you know, that kind of family financial planner. Nothing to do with financial aid, but you need somebody to look at your financial situation. That person can also tell you whether it makes any sense to use your equity in your home to pay for college. They can really look at the whole package, which is something none of us can do unless we had all your numbers in front of you. So it's got to be somebody who can look at the whole picture of how you're going to save and spend your money over a long period of time and invest it.
I agree. And the other thing Andrea said in her statement was a lot of this depends on how much money we're talking about.
Right.
To move a little bit of money one way or the other.
A few thousand dollars isn't going to matter.
I'm going to tell you in the end, I don't think it makes a difference. If you're talking about a pretty good pool of money, then it's a whole different, could be a whole different set of circumstances.
You may want to refer to the videotapes that are available. If you check the benefits webpage, there's a whole bunch of videos that were done last year as part of the 401k video workshops. That we're on. You may want to check, and I know there were discussions in those programs about selecting financial planners and helping employees begin to think about the process of financial planning. And those are available free, so you check the benefits homepage, Benefits and Work-Life Solutions Organization homepage, and I think you'll find some other information.
Well, I certainly appreciate all of you and Digital putting this together.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the call. Vicki?
Matris Manuel from New York City. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes. My daughter and I are right in the middle of the application process, and one of the critical parts of the application process is the essay. And I was just wondering if it was any specific topic she should steer clear from in writing when submitting her application.
All right.
How I spend my summer vacation.
That's a really good question. I think that I'm assuming then that the applications that you're making, the essay questions are fairly open-ended.
Yes.
Okay. I think one thing that I would try to avoid is redundancy. If one of the reasons why we look at essays, in addition to examining someone's writing skills, is to tell us something that we're not going to see in another part of the application, specifically if you're applying to a school that doesn't conduct evaluative interviews. The way we look at essays at Boston College is we actually have two sets of questions, one that is sort of a universal statement on why they're applying to Boston College. The other, we give them a choice of four options. And one of the things that we emphasize is to maybe write about a significant life experience that has had a profound effect on them. Maybe it's affected the way They're choosing a college. Maybe it's affecting their choice of major. Maybe it's affecting their work on their transcript on a day-to-day basis. So if I can sort of turn the question around and sort of give advice on what I would write about, I would try to emphasize topics that tell the admission committee a little bit more about as a person that I'm not going to see on a transcript or on a given Saturday or Sunday morning.
Okay, thank you.
One other quick thing is I don't think admissions office like to see excuses for why you couldn't do something unless you've had a profound family experience that's not reflected anywhere in your essay. But
right.
No woe is me or poor me kinds of essays don't really work. And or an excuse of why I did so poorly in English, you know, I had a broken toe for 6 months. They don't want to hear that.
Because that is so subjective, and
right.
Sometimes it can be exploited. But at the same time, I wouldn't want anyone not to write something that was clearly legitimate and clearly
right.
had a profound
so
impact.
Watch that.
Yeah.
So and the other thing is we always say introspective, something that shows you a little bit of what's inside.
Right.
Introspective, not about other people and other things, but something that reflects a little bit about you.
Is the college on the line? Hello?
Yes.
One thing that I would also emphasize is try to make the essay institution specific. I think that really helps if you can be, if you can kind of find a little bit about the institution and what they're looking for. Sometimes if you write a generic essay, it may not actually be a good fit for the school that you're applying to.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Vicki, do we have any more calls?
We have one more participant waiting in queue.
Go ahead.
David Swicker from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, everybody. My question is financial-based. Are there institutions out there or programs where, I'm assuming colleges want their yearly annual tuitions paid up front, are there institutions where you can apply for loans and actually defer yourself for paying off that note on a yearly basis and actually prorate it out to 2 or 3 or 4 years? Are there institutions out there? If there are, what are the typical interest rates that you might see for being in that kind of a program?
Hi, David. Just make sure I've got your question correctly. You're looking for some vehicle to finance your share of the education, not for just 1 year, but for 4 years.
Correct, and in more of a deferred payment, so you can continue to contribute or invest on your own on the side and defer actual payments until either the 4 years of college are up, or 2 years, or 3 years, or what have you.
Sure. The first thing is that potentially the student would be eligible for a student loan. And although that won't cover most likely the full cost of education, most of those loans have the option. The federal government pays while the student's in school, and others, the student has the option to defer the interest. So that's the first step I would tell you to look at. The second step, there's also from the federal government something called the PLUS loan, the parent loan for undergraduate students. With that particular loan, some lenders offer an interest-only period. It can be a 2-year or 4-year period, which all you do is pay interest. And that may be what you're looking for because your money's making better money someplace else. And so you say, well, I'm willing to pay this interest because my investments are not due for a certain period of time and or they're making more money. The other thing is that each individual college may have a selected group of financing options available to you, and I would encourage you to read their material to find out about that.
Great.
Okay, so what you're pretty much saying then is your first base should be try to select an institution or 2 or 3 and understand A, their scholarship programs, and B, their financial options, and then kind of put yourself in place from there.
My prediction is next May, when you're sitting down as a family trying to make this decision, you should have all this information in front of you. You're going to look at the college selection process from an admission standpoint, an academic standpoint, what institution best meets my son or daughter's needs, and then from a financial standpoint, what one can we afford and what one can we afford to finance. And
okay.
There may be several in the mix in the end, and you may have to drop a couple because you truly can't afford them. But that's a progressive process, one which you start now. And as I said, I think once you make those final decisions, you'll have all that information in front of you.
Okay, may I slide one more question related to financials while I have you?
It's up to our moderator.
Real quick, we're at the close of the conference. Go ahead.
Okay, real quick. My son is a junior right now, and I'm just trying to, you know, get going up front. As far as starting, you know, looking at financial aid and availabilities and scholarships, when would be the correct time? Again, he's a junior now. When would be the correct time, or is it too soon?
It's never too soon, and that's sort of a theme that we have in financial aid. The more you as a family understand about financial aid, the longer you give yourself the opportunity to learn about financial aid and your options, the better you're going to feel about making those decisions when they really need to be made the spring of the year in which that student's going to school. So I would encourage you, as Andrea said earlier, visit colleges. As Peter said earlier, to prepare for your for the proper test, doing the proper things. And as I tried to emphasize, as much as you can, learn as much as you can and read as much as you can about the financial aid process.
Okay, so you can learn about it, but you're really not eligible until your senior year, correct?
Correct.
Right. But it clearly, I think, as Mike's telling us, arming yourself with the information now will certainly make the process over the summer and into the senior year a lot easier and certainly perhaps a little less stressful. You're not going to avoid it, but you'll know a lot and you'll be managing with information you have at hand rather than trying to learn and apply and do all the things that has to be done during that senior year.
Okay, thank you.
I want to thank Mike Bartini, who's Director of Financial Aid Services at the College Board, for joining us. Andrea Glovsky with Work Family Directions. And you can write questions to Andrea electronically, because I know we're not going to cover everything. And for people who are who are going to listen to the replay of this broadcast, you can direct questions either by writing digital@wfd.com and say, "Attention, Andrea." And from there, she'll pass it out to her staff and try to get answers back to you in regards to college questions. Or you can call the service at 1-800-635-0606 and talk with a counselor directly about your concerns and use a variety of the materials that are available. Again, we invite you to visit the Work-Life Connections webpage, hr.imc.das.dec.com, inside the firewall, and for a whole host of information on that topic and a variety of other topics related to balancing work and home life. And Peter Caruso, thank you, who's Senior Assistant Director of Undergraduate Admissions at Boston College. It's a tough process out there. It may seem overwhelming. I think the goal is to keep organized and try to keep your sense of humor as you get through the morass of college planning. Thank you for joining us tonight, and thank you, Ted Evans, our audio engineer.
Thank you, Bruce.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. You may all disconnect, and thank you for participating.